You are listening to a University of Cambridge Faculty of Education podcast.
Estelle Morris is Baroness Morris of Yardley and spent 20 years, almost 20 years in education, including teaching at the pioneering comprehensive Sydney Stringer School in Coventry before becoming a Labour Member of Parliament in 1992. In 2001, Estelle became Secretary of State for Education and Schools, the first comprehensive school teacher to reach this position. I don't know if there have been any subsequently, actually. Perhaps you would know that. I don't know. During this time, as David has mentioned, David was head of QCA and was government advisor and worked very closely with her. However, Estelle resigned her post in 2002 in circumstances which surprised everyone but gained her very much respect. She stepped down as member of Birmingham Yardley for at the 2005 general election, but was shortly afterwards created a life peer. She has continued to be involved with educational issues, including within universities. She became the Pro Vice-Chancellor of Sunderland University in 2005 and Chair of the Strategy Board of the Institute of Effective Education at the University of York in 2007. Most recently, she has been appointed to chair the Museums, Libraries and Archives Council and the National Literacy Trust Commission to examine the future of school library provision in England. I've actually got one paper from Estelle that I keep very close to me, and it was a paper she wrote in The Guardian very shortly after she left Parliament, and she was talking about standards, not structures. So this is a very interesting issue that David has raised, and it'd be very interesting to see how Estelle addresses similar sorts of issues.
Thank you very much, thank you, and thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be speaking with David. We actually go back further than that. I always tell him the story that I'm not an academic by any stretch of the imagination. I feel relatively insecure in places like this. But when I was doing my teacher training at Coventry College of Education, when I got to my fourth year to do my BEd degree, I ended up with a third, I have to say, and still managed to teach for 18 years. I don't think I did too bad a job. I started doing sociology of education, and it was like finding a home, to tell you the truth, because I came to my academic work rather from politics. I'm much better at understanding what's around me and being interested in it, and of course sociology of education put a context around what I was interested in rather than studying sociology of education and then hoping it would inspire me to be interested in society. And so when I got to that third year of BEd, I had a great year, and it was the only year really in the whole of my academic work that I felt I did reasonably well, but I flunked the exams. And of my very first essay that I had to do, we had to choose a sociologist, and we had to choose one of his books and write a critique of it, and I chose David's book, and I got an A-. It was the first A- I'd ever got in my life, I can assure you. It's all downhill from then on. And when I became a junior minister and I found that, you know, David was around and I was working with him, he really was one of my heroes and mentors, and I rushed home to find the essay. You have to bear in mind, this is now nearly 30 years later. And I remember I'd kept all the essays, and when I left the house about 15 years ago, I'm pretty sure I'd left all my college work back, and I rooted for it, hoping it was there. I wanted to show it him, and I wanted to show the comments. I was never able to do that, and that's one of those little things I've always regretted, not saving my A-. So, David, I always think he's personally responsible for getting me my A-. So it was a delight to work with him, and a delight to, you know, to hear what he had to say today. And to some extent, his relationship to me is still the same. And that should be the relationship of academics to people who are interested in something but aren't academics. It gives them a framework for what they've been thinking and pushes their thinking still further. And David, that's what your talk did for me. We are on the same page, but you've left me with some challenges that I'll need to go back and think about. And I think what I want to say today is, coming from my experience, my angle, the things that I suppose the analysis I'm interested in, which is more the relationship of politics and education, and rather than trying to put an academic framework around it or a conceptual framework, I think I want to look back at what people in the bit of my life that is politics have done and how they've operated in terms of trying to achieve educational goals. I think if this, I was actually thinking today when I was thinking about my notes, if you're going to do a lecture series on education and the state, I think it becomes a very different lecture series than education and politics. And this is about education and politics not education and the state. And there's actually, there's not too much of a subtle difference, but there certainly is a difference. I suppose that just take it as given that all states have always used education to achieve its ends. And I suppose if you were looking, you're doing a lecture or seminar series on that, you'd go through anything from America to Cambodia with Russia and China in between, and we'd be there as well. Because education is just one of the most powerful ways, not only really of shaping the minds of the young, but of deciding which knowledge is most important and which knowledge is transferred from one generation to the other. And so the idea of the state and education, I think that's quite complex in itself, because I think politics and the state does have a role to play in answering those key questions. But I think where we are in our country at the moment, the more interesting debate is about education and politics and education and policies. And I think in my own mind, I very much bring politics and policies together, because no good being a politician unless you've got some policies to go at. So I think that I interchange them. And the reason this becomes more interesting is because I suppose that politics, unlike the state, is far more about ideas and exchange of ideas and developing ideas and changing your mind and competing policies. So when I argue with the Tories or I discuss with the Tories, it's not about the role of the state. It's actually about competing policies. And I think one of the things that's interesting about our time now, and it's why David could end his speech, his talk, the way he could, is there's actually great unanimity about what our ambitions are, whether we're right of centre or left of centre. We'd have gone back 30 years. I think the left politics has always wanted for the many, not the few. I think it's always been more ambitious for children from all working backgrounds, or has really held the candle for those children whom they felt the state let down. I wouldn't say that the Tories haven't always cared about them, but I think when you look at society that's not needed everybody to be educated at the highest level, I think the right politically has always been more at ease with that knowledge model. It's always been more relaxed about saying, well, come on, if we want to get the best out of society, we only need 20% who actually need to be educated to the highest level. And it's rested easy on a set of policies that's given it that, whether it be selection, whether it be other assisted places, because it's believed, this is not a criticism of them, that will do, that's what will deliver what society needs. Where we've been in the last 15 years is, no matter whether you're right or left, there is a burning need for an education policy that delivers for every child. And if it's not that you buy the economic model that we need a society which has got a high skill level, it's that you buy the social cohesion model, that if you don't get it right, you have fragmented families, fragmented communities, more people in the juvenile justice service, and the cost of remedying that is absolutely great. So I think, David, when you talked about a time of change, and this is why I think 1984, fine, for whatever reasons that happened, and I can see that, and what happened after that in terms of the national curriculum and the rest of it, I want to return to. But I think if you want to make an argument that now is a time of opportunity and now is a time to have these discussions and get it right, I think it's around that for different reasons, politically, both the left and the right have ambitions for the highest standards of education for all children. The irony is, teachers have always had that, but politicians' policy hasn't needed it. And I think that's just been a gap between those who teach and those who develop policies. And it's been one of some frustration over the last probably centuries, to tell you the truth. But we are all on the same page now. I think we've all realised, however we come at this discussion about education, the agenda at the top, the line at the top, is we need, for so many reasons, to have every child able to reach their potential. And as a political system, as a political generation, none of our previous generations of policymakers have ever tried to achieve that. I would make the case that they've actually been pretty good at achieving what they set out to achieve. They really have been pretty good. You know, the 80-20 society, 28 in terms of skills and not skills, the girl, boy, man, woman society, where it's much better women stay at home and look after the children. They've actually delivered quite well on that. They've always managed to produce an education system that has delivered that. the challenge now is greater. And I think that the problem with politicians now is it leaves them flummoxed. They don't know which levers to go for. They've not got a history that tells them how to deliver an education society that delivers for every child. They may have mouthed the words in previous generations, but none of their predecessor politicians have had to deliver it. And that's why now is important. That's why, in some ways, it is timely to have this series of events. I think if you go back, if I go back to when I was a child and I look at what the political divides were, what is a person joining the Labour Party at the age of 16 already interested in education? I go back to the Labour Party meetings and I try to think what the Labour policies were. I make my list of, they were on the whole about comprehensive education or selection. Believe it, in those days they were very radical. They're about ending private schools or not ending private schools, and now we don't discuss that any longer, which is actually quite interesting. They were about early years education, or whether that we didn't need early years education. I think that was reflected in a women and families should look after children before five rather than it be about the state. And I think to my own memory goes back to the 70s. It was about forms of assessment. Continuous assessment was more associated with the left. End of term exams was more associated with the right. And it was even in those days of 70s, really quirky, merging subject boundaries like interdisciplinary work, integrated humanities, was even in those days more associated with the left, and the straight subjects were associated in the right. And you mentioned Sydney Stringer, which was a pioneering school, and it was a very successful school in the 70s, but it absolutely went for integrated subjects, for continuous assessment. Do you remember Mode 3 CSEs, Mode 3 GSEs? We did all that. Our kids barely took an end of term exam because in those days we could go for 100% assessment. And although we weren't a political school, I can't remember too many teachers who weren't left of centre, and sometimes very far left of centre in terms of what they wanted to do. So there was a political divide in terms of what should happen to education. And I would say that's what it was back in the 70s. If you were right-wing, you didn't agree with those things. If you were left-wing, you did agree with those things. And I don't think we voiced it in the way. But in the 70s, we were beginning to look at the levers for bringing about change. That was where the debate was. And the years go by and the world doesn't change. We don't achieve the transformation, you're absolutely right. And we still want the transformation. We've always wanted transformation because there's no good being in politics unless you do. And I think we are probably, as a breed, we're on a different language level, I suppose, than the public. So I think what happened, and I suppose the Tories actually thought about this, politicians then actually say, well, what levers do we use? If those didn't bring about those change, what levers do we use? And I think there's been three phases of change over the last 30 years. And I think the first change, which I would hook, probably I'm now going back to the end of the Second World War, was, I'd say, 45 probably till the early to mid 70s. It was this belief in structural change, and it was about money. So left of centre politics said, if you change grammar schools for comprehensive schools, and if you give more money to working class children, we will have transformation. And that was the belief. That's what politicians believed they needed to do. And if you look at that range of policies, whether it was Crossland, whether it was Shirley Williams or whatever, it was about that structural change. And their agents for change were institutions. They were local authorities. And they gave the local authorities a lot of power. And if the local authorities changed from selective to non-selective, we really believed that we would end the social class divide. We really believed that we would end the inequality, because if you end the social class divide, we would end that inequality. And that didn't work either. And those levers of looking for institutional change, we get to the late 80s, and I think what we had for the next 10 to 15 years, I think where the levers of change for the politicians then was introducing a framework for education in which education should work. And these were the years of the Tories. And these were the years in which the national curriculum was introduced. We got the beginning of Ofsted. We got regular assessments. we got information in the public domain. They were really frameworks for education. And the way I like to think of it in my mind is that if you were a politician in the 70s, you saw your influence as stopping at the school gate. You fought to change the school signboard at the school gate. You fought to change it from grammar school to comprehensive school. And you tried to shove more money through the door, but you didn't go through the gate. Your levers stopped at the gate. And you just hoped that local authorities, who in those days were very often the whole of the governing body, could do that for you. It's interesting that Shirley Williams' biggest thing was instructing local authorities, 1065, was instructing local authorities to actually introduce comprehensive school. What bigger sign that when the Labour government of the 60s got frustrated that it wasn't getting as many comprehensive schools it wanted, it passed a law to instruct local authorities to make comprehensive schools. And can you remember the row over that? It was the biggest lever that government had ever used to bring about the change that it felt would end inequality. And so we got this framework. I think the Tories said, well, hang on, we really want to achieve this change. We're not going to stop at the school gate. We're going to look through the school gate and walk down the school path. But we're going to stop at the door into the school and the door into the classroom. So the framework, it was like they were stood in the playing field and they're going, you know, the steps that go up to these old grammar schools. They stood there and they made a framework for schools to work in. And we've known the consequences of that. And that has actually stayed with us. And I think that had a lot of strengths. I think in some ways it was the best form of CPD that teachers ever had, because it taught them things and began that process of questioning what good practice was and questioning their own practice. And then we came in, you had that phase. We came in 97 and the transformation still hadn't arrived. We'd still not changed society. We'd still not ended inequality. So where were our levers now? And that's the debate that politicians have all the time. What levers can I use? I think what Labour did, it climbed the steps, it opened the door of the school, it marched down the corridor to the classroom, opened the door of the classroom, and it introduced a series of levers that were about classroom practice. And if you look at them from the literacy strategy and the numeracy strategy, in 97, right the way through, there's a series of pedagogical interventions in classroom practice which has been Labour's way of transformation, bringing about changing the world and ending inequality. Some of them, I think, have been hugely defensible. We can go maybe to this in discussion. I think the literacy strategy and the numeracy strategy, given where we were in 97, were good things, essentially about professional development. Should have changed them earlier than we did, but they were good things and they were necessary at the time. Some of them have been more bizarre. I was associated with these or responsible for these just as much as anyone else. But the instruction that said 5 minutes homework if you're a primary school child, or things like that. I could think of a myriad of things, and they were about influencing classroom practice. So what we've seen in 30 years, 40, 50 years, is as the ambition for the nation grows, as the demands on the politicians increase, as the public and the voters judges by ever, ever higher standards, and let's be clear what they're asking us to do, they're asking the political system, and the political system has put its hand up and volunteered to be judged this way, and there's an argument there, to deliver what we've never had in the whole of the history of this country, and that's an education system that's delivered for every child and has done as well for the rich as it has for the poor, for the girls as much as the boys, for black children as much as white children. It's never been able to do that, and that's what the aspiration is. And in response to that, politicians are nervously grabbing at every strand they can and every lever. And one of the problems with that, and I think this is where I move away from being a politician to being an educationist, because I can see where it goes wrong. This is where I think David and I would agree. Once you actually have a set of policies that are about what happens in the classroom, I think as a politician, you've crossed the boundary between what is a proper relationship between education and politicians. And I think we've crossed it without having a discussion. And I don't think we've had a professional debate, let alone a national debate. And I think we need it. I think the justification for it is, and this is the justification I use as a politician, is that I'm elected by the people, I say I will raise standards, that's what my constituents want to do. If the changes that need to be made are changes in the classroom, well, there I must go. I can't stand back and say, not me, Gov. I'll do as much as can, I'll put the money in, I'll make the CPD available, but I'm stepping back. If the schools don't get it right, the heads don't deliver, if the teachers don't teach better, not me, Gov. Because at the end of the day, the politician gets the blame, partly because they volunteered to be judged by that set of criteria. And the problem is that when you've got a set of policies about pedagogy and about classroom policy, the culture of politics can't handle it. The way the culture of politics works, its time frame, its own accountability mechanism, the way it uses language, its habits and its customs are really ill at ease in classroom practice. I think part of the problem with the relationship between politicians and teachers is the custom and practice and the language in the classrooms is ill at ease with politics as well. They are two cultures that don't rest easy, and yet they are two cultures that need to be brought together to deliver for the children. So what I want to really argue today is that we have, without knowing it, crossed the boundary between politics and education, and we've merged the line in a way we've possibly never done before. And this is how ridiculous it's got. We now have both major political parties competing with each other as to whose version of phonics is the right one to make sure that every child can read and write by the age of 11. They all go for phonics. That, you know, politically, that's it. But the Tories, we're going to do synthetic phonics, and they're going to do a form of phonics which is even more synthetic phonics than synthetic phonics. I bet there's not a Labour or a Tory politician who knows the difference between synthetic phonics and phonics. I'm a teacher. I'm a trained teacher. And I don't know the difference between all the form of phonics. I'll be honest, I looked at the literacy strategy, and they were teaching 11-year-olds, but I'm not a primary teacher, I'm not an English teacher. The pedagogy of the literacy strategy passed me by when I looked at it. And to be honest, I was the minister who knew most about the pedagogy of the literacy strategy. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But for parties to go into the election arguing on whose form of phonics is better, God help the electorate and God help the teachers. And the other one that we now have political policies on, and this drives me mad, is how teachers should group children in classes. Both Labour and Conservative now have got policies that demand that teachers set children. Now, what we always did, our policy was, I hated it. I had to go along with it, but I hated it because I knew it was bad education, was that unless you can prove you can do it, you can teach effectively without, thou shalt set children. So thou shalt set children unless you've got evidence that anything else works. All the educational evidence shows that setting isn't the best way of grouping children. But it doesn't matter. It's a professional decision. So what I want to argue is five reasons why politicians make a lousy job of introducing policies on pedagogy. Firstly, politicians have a pretty poor relationship with research. Research is too long for them. The results take too long to come through. The time frame of really good research isn't a political time frame. We need results quicker. And we can't say to the electorate, just hang on, we're doing a longitudinal study. And I promise in 10 years' time that we'll have the first cohort ready. And I'm going to go further than that. I promise when we have that first set of data in 10 years' time that we'll adjust the policy if it's been proven not to work. So won't deliver for your children, but I promise we'll deliver for your grandchildren. It just doesn't work. The time frame is all wrong. Secondly, the nature of trust between education research and politicians is really poor. And I think both education researchers as well as politicians have to carry some responsibility for that. But it's a lousy relationship. Secondly, the combative nature of the political debate makes a political policy on pedagogy a recipe for disaster. That's why we've got the Tories saying thou will set children in class, and Labour saying thou wilt set unless you can prove you do it a different way. We said it first, so the Tories shut down, well, you don't have to set if you can prove there's a better way of doing it. It's what politicians do. That's what they do. They carve bits off other people's policies, even though they basically agree with it. So it's not really great to have the politicians get hold of anything that's a good pedagogical idea. Three, classroom practice needs stability. And political ideas don't give you stability. And therefore, I think if you allow politicians to make arguments about pedagogy, you risk stability. And four, and this is the main one, it really undermines the relationship of the policymaker with the professional in the classroom. And this is a huge issue. And it's partly where Labour's gone wrong for understandable issues, for understandable reasons. But I would still make the argument, I'm not really sure what David's views are on this. I think we got it right to begin with, but for lots of reasons, I think we should have moved away from it more quickly than we did. I think we had to move a big ship of state. I think we had to be pretty bloody minded about how we did it. But we didn't follow it up in a different way. And I think that's basically been our problem in terms of that. But while you've got politicians with policies on homework, policies on setting, policies on uniform, policies on all those things, I think it leaves the professional teacher unsure of where their professional expertise is actually of importance. And where I'd absolutely agree with David, I agreed with the analysis, perfectly really, is that it is the teacher at the end of the day that makes the difference. If all your diagram works, the one person that can thwart it at the end of the day is a bad teacher in the classroom. If you get everything else working, when you shut that door, if the teacher doesn't do what they're meant to do for their bit, even with the right support, it doesn't work. And I think once you've got political policies about pedagogy, I don't see how David's framework can actually operate, because it's like putting a spoke in the wheel of what otherwise is a sensible debate. So my argument is that we need to redraw those boundaries, and we need to say to politicians, you have a right and a responsibility to have policies to raise standards in education. You have an obligation to be accountable for how well our children do. And you should talk about what you want to see in our schools. But it's dangerous for you to go down that road of having policies that are about classroom practice. And I would say, look at your comrade politicians in the Department of Health. They don't have policies about which antibiotics a doctor should prescribe. They don't say that it shall be penicillin unless you can prove that the patient's allergic to penicillin. And equally, the Secretary of State for Health is never held up as responsible if an antibiotic doesn't work on somebody. Whereas if somebody can't read because the reading scheme's not worked, politicians are now in the case where they're held up as responsible for the child not being able to read. So what do? They behave in a politician's light way and go and develop another policy for teaching children. Whereas in the sensible thing with health, if an intervention doesn't work, well, then they research it and adapt it. So I'd say that politicians look down the road at what's happening in agriculture or what happens in health or what happens in social security, where it's more where it's more evidence-based. But what I would say is this. I'm not of the mind that agrees with the policy that therefore says, well, the answer is obviously then, leave it to the teachers. I'm second to none in my admiration for the teaching profession. But do I trust the teachers? No. Do I trust doctors? No. Do I trust university lecturers? No. Do I trust politicians? No. Not that I don't trust them in general, do I trust them specifically? With no framework, no advice, no intervention, no accountability? No, I don't. And I really worry at the moment that we're about to go from one of those big swings, from actually saying politicians should be out of this, so I'm agreeing there, leave it to the professionals, leave it to those who can trust. And I trust most teachers most of the time, but I worry about the kids who have been taught by some of the teachers for some of the time when they're not getting it right. And one thing I learnt in politics is you can't develop educational policy that works for good schools and doesn't provide a safety blanket for average and poor schools. We've got lots of good schools who will do the policy development for us, and the skill of the politicians is to take that out from it, as you said, as you do, and you make an academic framework and I make a policy for it. But the challenge all the time is the schools that aren't like that. They're not bad, they're not failing, they're not lazy, they're not unambitious, but they're not as good as those. And we all know that that's the way life works. And what I would like to do, I want to finish with this, that if I don't want politics intervening in the classroom, and I'm nervous about leaving it to the professions, well then it has to be somebody else. And I think there is an argument now for another organisation, whether it's like a NICE or a SKY that work in two other areas, to actually hold the ring between the ambitions and the temptation of the politicians to want to get in there because they know it makes a difference, and the professionals to say, well, I do need advice, I do need to turn to someone for help, but I need to know that they're trusted, that they're in it for the long term, that they're motivated by what I'm motivated, and they will give me an evidence base for which to work. And that's what I'd like to see at the next election. I'd like to see politicians actually say, over the last 40 years, in our ambition to do better for the nation's children, we've actually touched and used a whole series of levers. We stuck, none of them have given us to what we've aspired for. What's next? My worry is, I think, David, I'll finish on this, I think we both think at the end of the day that whatever the political parties say, their temptation, it is out of character with them, it's not in their DNA to take their hands off anything that they know is instrumental in making a change. And you know, that's a good thing. That's a good thing about politicians. They see something that they know can influence change. They want to get hold of it because they want to influence the change. And there's never been in politics unless you want to do this. But now's the time to actually say, pedagogy and political policies, and pedagogy is a policy too far, and it's time to redraw what essentially will be a quite wavering boundary between education and politics. I think that's the discussion that we ought to try and engender over the weeks and months to come. Thank you.